So it probably takes your point, Peter, a little further that you finished off with, which is about the future strategy, but I open it up to all the panel. It would seem like we are certainly heavily relies on space technology for various things that we're doing, many of which are bought from overseas and so on. And I just wonder about any comments that the panel has about really mapping that future out and then taking that as, if you like, an all of government, bipartisan, everybody agrees that in order for Australia to have assured access in these areas, this is the plan and this is the kind of investment. So not just stopping from a technical point of view, but actually comments from the panel about being able to inject that into a strategy that goes to government, and then, and if I can be kind of blunt and say, not just create a policy that says we should do these things, but then turning that into an actual budgetary line that comes into play from government, rather than talking about the need being there. So just interesting your comments as to how we get that pathway.
I've got a couple of other comments I can make on that, but let's start with Jennifer on that one.
Look, I think that is very important as a next stage to the policy, and certainly through the governance mechanisms such as the Space Coordination Committee and the Advisory Council, the Earth Observation Working Group, the Position Working Group, those sorts of issues will be discussed. And the idea of a roadmap, if you like, I think is a way forward. Certainly embedded in the infrastructure plans is a roadmap to progress some of these space capabilities. I think, this is a start. This very concise yet little realistic policy is a first step in this whole discourse on space capabilities and where we stand in the space community. And I think it's just the start of the story. So I agree with you, Jeff. I think the next stage forward is to consider all these priority areas and how we can feed that into something a bit more strategic and action-based.
John might have a
comment. Yes, well, I guess the policy document itself said it indicated support for space applications of national significance, and I think one of the planning activities we probably should get involved in is looking at the activities, whether they're CalVel, getting surface data, contributing to satellite systems in terms of instrument components. But we have to, I guess, the important thing is for us to be seen to be, a player in the scene, and also, I guess, a trusted team player. So I think that the support has to sort of cover all areas and has to leave Australia positioned as not only clearly an excellent user of the data, which we are, but also doing a fair share of work. Now, that could all be on the ground, but probably shouldn't be. But doing a fair share of work so that we're seen as a team player and a supporter of the international networks from which we benefit so much.
Just a final observation on that. We want to work out why. Why would we develop a strategy? And it's not just because it's usually a good thing to do. We should articulate very clearly where the nation thinks it wants to position itself, pardon the pun, in 10 years' time, the value in getting there, and some hard-nosed analysis as to why that's a good thing to do. I mentioned some figures on the benefits of positioning. You can go right across the spectrum of satellite use, and we could finalise the economic arguments for getting there. And then you can work back to the investments that are needed, the infrastructure, the people, the R&D, the innovation. And then you can have some serious conversations with Treasury, and industry can work at the value proposition at that stage. But without that kind of hard-nosed rigour, we're going to be continuing to look more like takers than like givers. So the momentum is now up with the satellite utilisation policy, and that's great. We're sending the right signals, both domestically and internationally, and that the next steps are to sort out the hard issues.
Can I just add something to this whole discourse of being takers and free riders? I think, you know, I strongly believe in labelling theory, and if we go around sort of saying that about ourselves, naturally our international partners will just think that of us. And I think we need to sort of be quite proactive and smart about our position in the spacefaring community. And even though this policy is not suggesting we get on board with creating spacecraft, etc., I think from what the feedback I've got from our international partners is that it's a really good step forward, and they're very pleased that Australia is now sending that signal that it is a serious player or becoming a serious player. So I think we need to be on the same page with that sort of message.
Jennifer, maybe the whole panel, in your introduction you indicated that there was part of the process to develop the policy was like there was kind of an audit took place, and part of that identified, I think, 90 areas of government that make use of the satellite. I'm wondering if there's any, and it sort of feeds into what you were just talking about, are there any metrics or measurable elements, for example, expenditure, that Australia, the government, private business make internationally for space services and space products that can be perhaps tracked and as a result of policy brought onshore, you know, so the government is spending domestically on that? Is there some way of working out that?
I think there are some metrics around, and certainly we could look into that as part of our role as the Space Coordination Office, and that's a sort of piece of work we would happily do. But we do take advice from our stakeholders on these sorts of pieces of research. Obviously, we only have 5 people in the office at this point, so we are a bit thin on the ground. But yes, I'm sure there are some statistics around, metrics around that would address your particular interest.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the one of the 4 or 5 reports that informed the satellite utilisation policy was a survey of Australia's use of space services by Futron, I think it was. Yes. And I think that put us very high on the international ladder. Yes. In terms of usage, so without having...
That'd be the $1.3 billion figure, I think.
$1.3 billion, yes. So it was... all of these reports are available on the space.gov.au website in the section on the new satellite utilisation policy. So if you're interested in seeing the research and the data and the... information that informed the policy, it's all there and it's all public.
But certainly any specific requests about the metrics attached to the space industry, space sector, feel free to approach us, and then we can perhaps tailor something specific to your request beyond just the overarching research reports that are on our website.
Next question, Jack.
Yes, I want to explore a little bit more about this freeloader idea. The data policies that we've had, the free-to-ground data policies, have been in place for probably the last 40 years. So NOAA and the geoimagers. But today, with the financial situations globally, it looks to be maybe a shift away from free data, and I wonder what that's going to mean for the Bureau and for other Australian agencies who enjoy the free-to-ground concepts, but in the future may be paying. For example, in AsiaSat's going to launch a satellite with a hyperspectral sounder on it. That's part of GeoMetSat. Clearly, that's not going to be free, and will Australia have to buy that service, or will they not upgrade their systems and not make use of this exciting technology? In Taiwan, there's a cosmic system that's going to provide global GPS occultation. That again won't be free. Maybe there's some exchanges that Australia can barter for hosting a ground station. But the overall question is, can we feel comfortable about getting free data in the future?
Asking me?
Okay. There's been free exchange of data since the time of Admiral Fitzroy, and I mean, even during the Cold War period in the 1960s, the Americans were happy to provide data, you know, over the Iron Curtain. So it's been a great policy, and I expect the way things will develop, it'll continue on. The data, say, from the next generation of satellite here, is free access, but it's not free, because what happens is we're not having direct broadcast, so from the next series of GEO it'll actually come along a landline, so the cost of getting images into Australia has gone up considerably. So I think there is costs associated, but I think I guess the general policy must be in most people's minds internationally is you sure share the costs according to your gross national product, and that's certainly probably what's been happening around the world. And I would expect that, there will still be free exchange of data, I think we'll have to probably pay more in terms of costs, because so the delivery might be a little bit different into the future. And I think what will happen, we'll also get more involved in being participants in the network from which we benefit. If that's an answer to your question, I think there'll be free exchange, but I still think the cost will go up.
Can I follow up that question by asking, is there a scenario in which we could contribute in kind something to set off the cost of access?
Yeah, we do that. I mean, for a lot of space activity, we've provided CalVel for satellites. In terms of, say, the research activity we do in the Bureau, like we're involved in generating winds from space, well, a lot of that software is now over being used by NOAA. So there's already a lot of exchange of expertise and knowledge, and we've built the focal plane arrays for LATSR and so on. So I think there's already been quite a bit of exchange, but I guess it's more probably some people, I won't use that word again, but some people are questioning the balance at the moment, and I think that's where we have to perhaps look carefully.
And we're publishing our positioning findings for the world to use, yeah. So that's a significant contribution there. It's worth just breaking your question out into a couple of components, I think, Jack, because we've got Earth observation, and John's given a view on that, and then we've got positioning, which is a very important component of this. The positioning signals are free at the moment. But the solution that we're talking about, this precise positioning solution after you've corrected, will probably come out as a subscription cost. There'll be a cost associated with it. Probably a very modest cost, because the number of users will be very large, the cost base will be spread very wide, and that will be sufficient if government operates the systems to maintain and improve the infrastructure that delivers them. Now, this infrastructure on present costs will probably be around about $200 million to install, and maybe $30 to $50 million a year to operate. And even when you do the numbers, it is a massive beneficial cost ratio, given that $32 billion benefit that I spoke about for over 20 years. So there is a cost signal that's likely to be there in the value-added component. The other thing to recognise is that these Earth observation data and positioning data, really only as good as the other information that goes with them that gives you a great map product or great analytical product. And a lot of that data is also geospatial. And the governments of Australia have agreed in principle to make that data freely available. They're also making significant steps towards improving the access to that data. So the discovery mechanisms and the access mechanisms are becoming vastly more simple. The licensing issues, vastly more simple. So we are, as a nation, making a lot of progress there. But not all of those data that I've indicated are geospatial will be freely available. At this point in time, we haven't argued well enough with treasuries to make the cadastre data and the property data and so on, all freely available. There's a cost associated with them. If you could develop a national interest analysis, which showed that giving it away was better to the bottom line of the economy than trying to license it through a government agency, and you can convince Treasury, then I'm sure governments would move in that direction. We've tried. It's been tried globally. It's very hard to mount that argument. Maybe one day we'll crack it.
Peter, that's interesting, but it assumes that the primary source of that signal is free. But it isn't. The GPS program, I don't even know what the current numbers are, but they're well over $60 billion. Okay, so those are very significant space assets. And in all cases, to put anything into space is costing the country a fair amount of money. Now in Asia, we've got lots of very active players in the space domain, and I suspect in some ways they recognize their need for space systems and how it contributes to their society, and also they probably recognize the vulnerability of having to rely on someone else to have those. Perhaps they're more vulnerable than we are. I don't know, but there is a huge cost to putting things in space, and the countries that have been doing it over the last 50 years may not be able to continue to do that.
Mm.
I'm going to take that as a comment and move on. There are a number of other questioners. John Coakley.
Hello, at the risk of asking a challenging question, perhaps another challenging question. I've read through the document and I've listened to it all tonight, and I can't find anything in the document that's going to inspire the Australian people to support this policy. It seems to me that the car is going down the road firmly with the handbrake on. And I've been conducting some research, I'm at Swinburne University, conducting some research about what are the funding drivers and the policy drivers for space funding for the last 50 years all around the world. And the thing that has consistently come out is that public support drives political support drives funding dollars. And I think if somebody from outside the space industry were to pick up this document, they would say Australia has basically abdicated its responsibility to participate in space. I'd like a response.
Shall I have a go first, Jennifer, or are you itching to get at him on this one?
You can have a go first, and I'll add to it.
That's a kind of a devil's advocate position. Yeah.
The academic position.
the alternative is nothing, and so that compared with what we've got is unacceptable. We've made significant steps by bringing together the collective agreement of all the jurisdictions in Australia and all of the major players outside of government to get us to this point. Now this is a journey, and it's great that after 15 or 18 years we've now got an agreed government policy on the table. There are next steps associated with that. And I've outlined what I think perhaps they might be, which is to drill into the next level of strategy. I can tell you that myself and my colleagues are energised by the policy, and we've got the ability to do things now that it's there, and to invest and to galvanise a wider range of partners and to make a significant difference to our nation. So there's a tangible example of how the policy is helping us. Now, I'm sure John has got a comment.
I read through this document, and I guess, like you think, where's this really leading us? It's only 21 odd pages, so it can't put detail and can't write down the benefits and maybe go through the descriptions, say, like some of the Academy of Science documents and so on. But I read back through, and the thing I noticed was it actually said it indicated support for space applications of national significance. And in earlier documents I'd read almost statements that precluded putting hardware in space, or documents that had that sort of overtone. This one I think was more showed a general support for space applications of national significance, and and I guess applications that have significant security, economic, and social impact. And so, just reading that part of it, I thought this is, you know, if that's what's really meant, I thought then there are a lot of activities that I can name, and positioning, and I guess disaster management. There are a lot of areas where you think that these words would indicate a reasonable degree of support. Now, if that, I mean, and they say that in black and white, so I'm expecting to get, even though it's not a sexy document in terms of showing the applications or the improvements like I did, it actually talks about the support in black and white, so I'm hoping that, you know, that will be then carried on to some, you know, tangible activity which will, you know, position us better into the future.
Yes, I agree. I think it's the first chapter in the story of, I guess, of the government's commitment to space capabilities. And I think you have to see this document as very symbolic. It's sending a signal out there that the government does understand how important space capabilities are for our social and economic well-being. I think it's a very accessible document, so anybody outside the space community can pick this up and understand what it's all about. And through that understanding, it's a, if you like, an educative process for people. They realise how important space capabilities are, how we really depend on them, how we need to link in with stakeholders, with international partners, to maintain access to these capabilities. So it may not be sort of meaty in terms of, mapping out the technical elements of space activities or the money side of things, but I think it's quite clear under the principles what we need to do, what actions we need to take. And I think that's the start of this very important story.
I guess question to Jennifer. I mean, all the words that have been used to describe it, it's a nice document, and simple, and it's reassuring and pleasing and all those sort of things. It's also a very modest, it's a very modest document, a very modest policy and strategy, and the mechanisms for following it up pretty low level in the overall government scene. And I guess one thing that I bristle a little bit at is the, you know, it's the first chapter, I'm sorry, but we've had much more ambitious and much more, I guess, hopeful first chapters every 5 or 7 years for the last 40 years in Australian, you know, Australia's aspirations for space. I suppose my question is, viewed from within the present structure of the present government, what do you think the Australian space community, however described, should be best trying to do to build the momentum to get the significant leap up that we clearly as a country have to take at some stage to be a really serious proper player in the global scene? You know, I guess I've been in government, was in government for a long time, and I suffered all the frustrations not knowing how to do it, and I wonder if you know, in your sort of either your most positive or your darkest moments, you can see how we might make that next step.
Well, my understanding is that this whole process captured everybody's views. It's a very concise document, but it went around to all industry stakeholder groups, to research bodies, to state and territory governments, and we are relevant agencies. So it was a very in-depth process, capturing all those views, those concerns about the space sector. So I guess if this isn't your story, then probably my advice is to rethink what you want as a sector and make that explicit to government. Because we think that this has captured what the industry wants and where we stand currently in the space community, and where we should stand in a realistic way in the space community.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Of John.
A quick one.
Yeah, John. Name the top three things that you would like to have seen in it that it doesn't have.
A substantial national space focus by body and a substantial government commitment to with funds to the development of space industry.
So a budding NASA, as it were, or something.
A budget, not
yeah.
A